Let's talk.
John Brown. Breaking. How the media works, when it doesn't, and why it matters. The modern media is breaking. Now more than ever, the media is crucial in shaping what we know about the world around us. So what happens when this vital part of our society fails in its basic role? How can we even begin to understand the mess that it is in? A controversial statement, but my next guest is well placed to write the book Breaking. It's Mick Wright. Mick, good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles. Glad to be here.
Pleasure's all mine. For those who don't know of your oeuvre, shall we call it? Well, I mean, you've been in the noble profession of journalism for some time now, haven't you?
Yep, about 20 years now. It makes me I feel old saying that, but yeah, about 20 years. At
We should all get medals for that sort of thing. Anyway, it's a statement. The breaking. The media is broken. Is this because of an age of social media? Everybody's looking for fake news, the truth socials. What was the thing that made you want to write this book and say this is good? I need to do something about this.
I guess partly it was that I've been writing a media criticism newsletter since really the dawn of the COVID era, sort of 2019, 2020, and hearing from readers of that newsletter about the things that they didn't understand about the media, or that they were confused about how the media worked, why certain things happened. And I felt that there was this desire for a better understanding of how things worked and why things broke and didn't work. So that was it, really. And I think also that in the past, in the 90s, even into the early 2000s, in the British media, there was quite a lot of media critics and media sections in newspapers. And that's not so much the case now. The media doesn't do a very good job at analysing itself anymore. So, you know, there was a gap to fill.
Also, is it a point, because, well, you know, I grew up sort of as a kid reading the Sunday Times colour supplements in the 70s and the early 80s and stuff. And you didn't question what was in, if it was in the Sunday Times or if it was in your newspaper, one of the broadsheets, 9 out of 10, you think of the stuff that Harold Evans did, and, you know, with Tina Brown, with the insight teams and stuff like that. And it was gospel. You took that as read. However, have we seen a shifting from proper journalism into PR, into fluff, into advertorials, first off, for example?
Yeah. And I think that's been the case for quite a long time. You know, look back sort of 10, 15 years ago when Nick Davies published Flat Earth News, which, you know, really took apart the amount of PR material that is in the press. So yeah, that's an issue. I mean, there's still a lot of excellent journalism out there. And one of the reasons I wanted to write the book was to allow people to identify what is good versus what is bad, you know, see the wheat from the chaff. It's not just about saying everything is terrible and, you know, we're going to hell in a handcart.
Is it perhaps because so much of our media is now controlled by one or two basically companies / individuals? Obviously Murdoch and his News Corp comes into the fire around first off, and they have an agenda and they know the tremendous power that the media can wield.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. And it's also an issue when you look at things like local media in the UK, where, you know, you've got two really big companies that own most of the local media. It's NewsQuest, which is a subsidiary of a big American company, and Reach, which owns the Daily Mirror, amongst other things, but owns a lot of the kind of local sites in the UK. So, yeah, there's a paucity of viewpoints in the mainstream press because of a limited number of proprietors.
I mean, because the business model has now changed as well, because before you were reliant on, if you were a local paper, you got your local news from there. You had a dedicated newsroom. You would go out there as a cub reporter. You went out there and you covered the court cases. And I don't know, here comes the first cliche of the day, but, you know, the prize marrow winning in the village fate sort of situation. And now it's become centralized and syndicated, and it's advertised now more than ever. It is driven by advertising, perhaps people who've not worked in media. This is my generation, but I'm thinking of the constant battles that you know, Channel 4's excellent Drop the Dead Donkey had between the newsroom and the editorial, the newsroom and the advertising, you know, Sir Gus and all that. But has that changed? And now with social media, of course, because people don't pay for their news very often now, they get it all online. Has that again changed the way the model, that there isn't the investment into independent news, you know, putting boots on the ground, as it were?
Yeah, that's definitely true. And I mean, when you look at local newspapers, there's also an issue around, say, court reporting. What's tending to happen quite a lot now in the UK is that the police will put out a press release about what has happened in a court case, and that will then be published in the local paper, because, you know, they haven't got the resources to put court reporters out there, which means that a lot of the time, the official line from the police is the only one you hear about a particular court case. And there may be other things that have gone on there that are a little bit more complicated.
The other thing, of course, is the fact that, you know, I'll stop banging on about social media, but it is it used to be, you know, get yourself three decent independent sources to verify the story before you put it out there to make sure there's no mistakes. Now it's been turned on its head. It's get it out there straight away, before your rivals do, get the clicks on the thing. And what that does, and that's got two things. A, nobody's checking anymore. And B, as a journalist, and I've seen this in local paper newsrooms, they are literally just scanning people's social media accounts to get a story together. So rather than getting down there and seeing what's going on, if there's been a knifing in a city centre, for example, rather than dispatching a young journalist down there to find out what's happening, these people are just instead looking at social media, they're looking at, you know, videos on or TikToks or whatever. And from that, they're forming a story, because it has to get out of there quickly, and that is a very dangerous thing, because you have no verification of that whatsoever. It could be a knifing from a completely different part of the world, for example.
Yeah, that's very true, and the problem for a lot of the young journalists who are working in these organizations, they're required, you know, to pump out, you know, 10, 15, 20 stories a day, which is a completely, you know, unsustainable amount of product to put out if you're going to check the facts on everything, if you're going to do your due diligence, if you're going to get out and talk to people. It's not possible to do, which is also why you see across sites in the UK that you'll see, you know, a story about, you know, a woman who from Wales who complains about an all-inclusive holiday and she didn't like the buffet in it. And then it's then covered in where I live in the EDP in Norwich is running that story for some reason. You think, well, this has nothing to do with your audience. Why are you doing this? And it's merely because that story was, you know, getting some clicks.
And also, it's the fact you mentioned it before. You mentioned the thing about the police putting out a statement, and it being basically, and again, when I was editing magazines back in, you know, when dinosaurs ruled the earth, but it was a case of with anything that came out of and I was working in international property, so therefore it was, you would change the first line of the first paragraph of the press release and the last paragraph, and sometimes just swap them around, and then you had your quarter page to fill, you know, and again, I mean, that was just for sort of quarterly property magazine, so it wasn't a civilized situation. But if you're taking that from a source and then reprinting it as news, yes, you may be getting the stuff out there, but you are insidiously undermining the value of your operation, because people will one day call you out when that's not proved to be the point.
Yeah, and you know, we see it in declining trust in outlets. You know, one of the upsides, or one of the more positive sides of this, is that there are, you know, across the UK, there's been a growth in new local outlets starting up on places like Substack. You know, starting up and doing real reporting and showing some of these big outlets up with that. So there are still people out there trying to do good and real reporting on local stuff. And, you know, it's worth noting that stuff like the Manchester Mill in Manchester has become a very good alternative to something like the Manchester Evening News that was increasingly feeling like it was putting out kind of just dreck.
Which is really, because the Manchester Evening News in the 50s and 60s was an absolute titan. My uncle worked on the Manchester Evening News before he went to work on the Mirror, for example. And so therefore, that was one of the steps that you went before you went on to a paper like the Daily Mirror, which in the 60s and the early 70s was known for its campaigning on proper issues, not campaigning for something that will, get our World War II veterans to Normandy, even though there's only a certain amount of them remaining. And that perhaps just goes to show how far those sort of building blocks of a journalistic career have disappeared, basically.
Yeah, it was very much a case, I think there was a sort of golden era in the middle part of the 20th century when people could come into the industry and move up through local newspapers and get into the nationals. You mentioned Harold Evans. I mean, Harold Evans, starts as a copy boy in a local newspaper and ends up being one of the most storied and famous editors in Fleet Street history. That kind of thing, very difficult to happen now. And I think, that's why you've got such a paucity of particularly class diversity in journalism. There used to be a lot more working class journalists than there are now, even though there's a lot talked about in terms of getting people into it. It's not as easy to do because, the financial incentives aren't there.
I mean, I know we were talking about people go, oh, well, but everybody's their own editor because they're all taking their own news. The algorithm says so. But there is good news from this sort of situation, because if you think of organisations such as, the £400 whatever in the room, the BBC, for example, which is being beset by problems because every time, if you have to look at the front pages and various light entertainment figures are being thrown out of their jobs left, front, centre. But you look at those journalists who perhaps have left high profile. I mean, I'm talking serious journalists here. I'm talking Maitlis or people like that. And they've left these employers. And once upon a time, that would be it. They'd be out in the wilderness. But now, due to Substack and due to podcasts, they can now report almost the shackles are off because they can have their own. I mean, think about the news agents, for example, the news agent podcast, which people listen to. You are grinning there with a sort of like you just sucked a bit of lemon there, Mick. Go on.
Well, no. But in fairness, the news agents is a product of global of global media, which is a massive radio powerhouse of an organization. So yes, but they've gone there and they have a huge amount of resources behind them. But yeah, you're right. There are a lot of other areas where things like podcasts that are allowing an increased number of independent work out there. But the trouble is, for that kind of thing, is if you don't have quite a lot of resources behind you, it's very difficult to do things like investigative reporting, because the legal environment is pretty onerous, in terms of breaking any kind of news. Still, you need a big player behind you to do big investigations.
And this is perhaps the thing, isn't it? Because we were talking about the role of the journalist against the role of the PR firm and making it all puff pieces. And entertainment journalists. I mean, what if you get yourself banned? There's double-edged sword to that, because a lot of PA firms or PR firms are finding themselves a bit of a disadvantage because now that everything you want to know about your celebrity or your football player, your sports personality is out there on the Instagram. So there's very little you can actually reveal in the way that you could perhaps before. But at the same time, as a journalist, you don't want to get blackballed from the aforementioned peer public relations, because you'll never get another audience with the aforementioned sports or film star.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that the days of hard hitting celebrity interviews, occasionally you get one now and again now where there's a kind of an interesting interview where someone's pushed hard, but yeah, generally it's an access business, because celebrities have these platforms like Instagram where they can get to their audience directly, they're a lot less likely to come and do these big press interviews unless their demands are very, very much acceded to. Yeah, and you see it as well, you see it with stuff like footballers now and the way the footballers deal with the press, they can really make demands as to how they're represented and presented and how their sponsors are talked about and that kind of thing.
So the media it's broken, that's the headline of the story title of the book. how do we go around fixing it? Do we, as consumers of media, need to be more educated? Because this has been one of my bugbears when people saying, "You see, they're putting, you know, they're putting transmitters in my cornflakes in the morning," and because I saw it on social media. A lot of people aren't their own editors, so or have to become their own editors. And we've always, again, trusted that people who used to do our newspapers had been trained in, you know, had to run it through the legals, etc., and how to check a good story. How do we, as individual citizens, as it were, check our media to make sure that what we're getting isn't a puff piece, it isn't one-sided, it's balanced, and so therefore we can form, because it's very easy to go down a rabbit hole, and this is what we've seen, obviously, since the pandemic, that people have become much more black and white in their views rather than the, you know, the interesting shades in between that. So how do we go about educating ourselves, or do we need to, Mick? What's your views on that, then, Mick?
I think we definitely need to. I think that there's a big issue, has been for a long time, of framing media studies and media literacy as a kind of Mickey Mouse subject, when in fact, you know, we should be encouraging our children to be very curious and skeptical about what they read, whether it be on news websites or whether it be on social media. I think that we have to be willing to, you know, challenge and debate and talk to sometimes older people in our families as well. I mean, I often, you know, I around Father's Day, I was encouraging people to buy this book to get it into the hands of their relatives who believe everything the Daily Mail says. But yeah, we need to be more skeptical, but we also need to be willing to read more, willing to look at a range of sources before we come to a conclusion on something, and also have a willingness to an ability to understand that any provider of information has their own agenda as well, and to try and understand those agendas a bit more.
Do you think that we need people to engage more? Because the thing you mentioned, the Daily Mail, and this morning's, you know, today's this morning's Daily Mail has got something about it's proof that Labour doesn't want you to work because the benefits system has worked. They've worked out on certain benefits, you're going to get whatever it's 500, 2,000 more than if you were telling away, you know, on the minimum wage. And that's what some people take away from their newspapers. They will read the first. We have now become conditioned that if we don't, we read the first 10 seconds of it, or engage for 15 seconds, and that's it. So we don't read the 2,000 word article, you know, the 10,000 word piece in a Sunday magazine, for example. And we've now become so conditioned to, oh, that's a bright, shiny thing, click. Oh, that's a bright, shiny thing, click, and moving like that, that we don't consider, we don't take the pause, we don't reflect on our news. We just go, oh, that's just what's happening, you know, Farage is right, or Starmer's right, or, you know, it's the immigrants, or it's not the immigrants, or, you know, it's the things in me cornflakes, Mick.
Yeah, and I it's quite difficult to encourage people to do that more. I mean, I also recognize that people don't have the time, you know, people don't feel they have the time, and emotional stories that are written to hit your emotions, they do that, you know, that it's very easy to just take the line that hits you right in the gut. But I just think we have to challenge it more. We have to have more conversations, and we have to have this willingness to understand that these stories are designed to make us emotional, and to step back a bit, to be more analytical if you can. And I think it's possible. You know, I've seen it with relatives of mine over the years when I've encouraged them to think a little more about certain stories, and it can change their views on things. And it can lead them to be a little bit more sceptical. I think scepticism is the watchword, really.
Obviously, you spoke to others in the media because you've been around for a bit. I mean, is this something that everybody is feeling? I mean, and are they willing to speak to you? Presumably off record, because if you are working in the newsroom of a well-known newspaper or a podcaster or radio station, and you say, yeah, actually, all we do is take on, you know, what Dua Lipa's hair colour is this week. You know, that's the main story, rather than, you know, the Ukraine being invaded or something like that. I mean, they must sort of look askance at the gods for this one. I mean, what's the underlying feeling that you got, Mick?
Well, I did talk to a lot of people in all sorts of different areas of press, you know, including and media, including, you know, people who, like, there's a whole chapter about interviewing, and I talk to people who do major interviews with politicians and others on big broadcasters in the UK. I talk to a lot of political reporters for the political reporting chapter. So, and I think the feeling from a lot of journalists is that they feel that journalism is always under attack, yeah. And that, you know, sort of saying, well, we're not trusted now. So is this helpful that you're now saying we need to be criticized even more? But yeah, there's a lot of stuff in there in the book that people gave me a sense of the pressures they're under, particularly in the BBC chapter. I talked to people within the BBC in the sense that they have, that there's a, you know, a real star problem, a problem with big names versus the kind of troops on the ground who do the hard work and don't necessarily like what happens with the highly paid sort of big celebrity names in there. So yeah, there's a lot of that. I talked to a lot of people. It's not just my voice in there, and there are, you know, counterpoints to points I make as well.
But you see, this is the thing. I mean, you mentioned political interviewing, and the way that politicians now respond to questions, and this is taking a leaf out of perhaps, you know, what's happening across the pond, but they will just continue to not, I will not confirm or deny this. I will, you know, give me the answer, or they will say the same thing. This government is firmly committed to, you know, wearing a purple hat in the style of Carmen Miranda on a Tuesday or something like that. And then you've got your Nick Ferraris just asking the same question again and again and again. And we as the audience go, oh, for goodness sake, Ferrari, you know, go change up a gear or something and just let's ask a different question. But if the politician is just doubling down, And not giving the answer, is it a yes or no, then, you know, the fundamental relationship between the press and the politicians have changed, because now they are in a situation where they can't go off message in a way that perhaps sort of a maverick politician of 20 years ago could have done, you know, a Kenneth Clark or whatever.
Well, I think the fact that a lot of politicians just do the stonewall it, you know, play it with a straight bat approach to interviews is the reason why someone like Farage is able to get a lot of time on broadcast, because he sounds different. You know, he sounds like he's answering questions, even though actually when you listen kind of carefully, he's not really. It's the same thing with a Boris Johnson initially. There was a sense of novelty because he answered in a different way. I think over time, you see, you go back in history, and there was a lot of deference to politicians when politicians were first interviewed in broadcast media, and that you know, that changed, and you get into the Robin Day era, which was, you know, a lot more combative, and that got even stronger around the Paxman era, and they learned to deal with that. And the other thing, it comes back to the same thing we were just talking about, sports people having different platforms to get to the public. Politicians, in a way, kind of have the same thing now. They have an ability to get directly to the public. So it can be more difficult for broadcasters, because sometimes politicians think, well, why would I bother going on there? It's only going to get me in trouble. I can get at things more directly. And we definitely saw that during the Boris Johnson government, where he wouldn't appear on stuff like Good Morning Britain, and people were saying, well, why is he not doing that? And you think, well, it wouldn't benefit him. There was no reason to go and get slapped about by Piers Morgan of a morning.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, yes, I'm with you on that one. What should, I mean, we obviously, people, and by the way, listeners, you can order the book via our own virtual bookstore on the TRE website. But, I mean, we want people to go and buy the book, but what should they be, if we give the listeners a first sort of red flag to look out for, Mick, and to tempt them into buying your fine tome, then what should they be? If I'm scanning through my social media feeds, I've picked up my newspaper today, my tabloid, my broadsheet, whatever. What sort of things should I be looking out for, do you think, in particular?
I think you should be look at what the sources in a story are. Is it just entirely predicated on anonymous sources? Most political stories are. Is it a story about something that hasn't happened yet but might happen? Often that's, you know, political parties or political actors sort of floating a policy before they even want to do it. Be cautious around things like surveys. I mean, it's an old one, but like, yeah, you'll often see things like, you know, 43% of people say X, Y, or Z, but often those surveys are very small, a very small number of people done for a brand to push a certain value that the brand wants to push. So it's, I think looking at sources is always the key thing, looking and looking for kind of weasel words, you know, stuff like that will help if you just look carefully and think, well, what is the angle here?
Yeah. I used to work on a newspaper, and a source was always a different one, because a source, if a source or a friend, doesn't say the actual person, but a friend said, and that invariably would be another journalist in the newsroom. You know, a source said, well, I think he's dyed his hair pink because, or, you know, because if you don't name your sources, unless it's a situation where you can't, because it's a whistleblowing situation. But if we're saying, you know, if you're talking about a celebrity or a football player, a source said, well, I saw him leaving in his Lamborghini with 15 dancers from this nightclub. But the source isn't named, then you just think, okay, well, where does that actual source come from?
Often if it says a friend or something like that, yeah, when it's a celebrity story, if it's a positive story, it's their agent. You know, it's their agent or their PR. Like, a lot of celebrity stories are still placed. You can see that. Those are quite obvious.
Yeah, and if it's a story live from Cannes, for example, you know, as the Daily Mail used to have this guy who was in the, you know, live, you know that every story there has been researched and given, you know, slid along the bar top to him as he's having his eighth bottle of Prosecco of the evening. What do you hope that people are going to get from this book, Mick?
I hope it'll allow people to know what bad journalism is, call it out, spot it when it's there, and then allow them to spend more time with good journalism, basically. And I think it should help people understand a little more about why things happen within newsrooms and within broadcasters and publications as well. And also the key role of cock-ups as well over conspiracies, you know, because another big problem in the modern era is that people assume everything is a conspiracy when actually you're dealing with an industry that is mostly human beings. I mean, a lot more AI coming in now, but that there are human beings there, and personalities and rivalries and jealousies play a big role in it as well, and there's a lot of that in the book. So
absolutely, the book is called Breaking How the Media Works, When It Doesn't and Why It Matters. It's by Mick Wright, who's speaking to you today. You can order it, as I said before, on our own virtual bookstore. Go into the bookstore, you see the front page, click on it, and it'll be winging its way to you by a well-known delivery service. Mick, if people want to follow you, say lovely things to you, where's the best place to find you online?
Yeah, lovely things only, please. I'm at Broken Bottle Boy on pretty much all places.
Why Broken Bottle Boy, by the way?
Oh, it was a thing I wrote in a poem when I was a kid ages ago, and then I made it my social media handle years and years ago, and then people now know me to find me at that, so I kind of got stuck with it.
Right, basically. I just thought it was a particularly interesting report where you had to smash your way out of some well-known, out of the Groucho.
No, I wish.
Out of the Groucho with a broken bottle of bit of Sapporo or something like that.
Just some alliteration that I got stuck with, basically.
The book is called Breaking. It's by Mick Wright. Mick, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Thank you.